Up next, we're going to talk about your health and what is really going on. Ralph Moss, my guest, Doctored Results, the cancer industry, a couple of his works, and he'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you about Ralph Moss, a medical writer, Dr. PhD. Ralph Moss has written at least 15 books on questions relating to cancer research and treatment. He was a science writer and assistant director of public affairs at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York for the past 35 years. Back in 1994, he was formally invited by Harold Vamas, MD, the director of America's National Institute of Health, to be a member of the Alternative Medicine Advisory Council, where he became a co-founding advisor to the Office of Alternative Medicine. Also, there's a documentary out called Cancer Therapies. See Second Opinion. It's Eric Mercola's work. And here is Ralph Moss on Coast to Coast. Ralph, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, George.
Tell me, now, someone who has been so extensively involved in medical research and medical work, how did you decide to start writing books on the cancer research and treatment? How did that all come about?
Well, in 1974, I was hired as the science writer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, as you said. And within about a month, I met a distinguished researcher named Kanamatsu Sugiura, a Japanese-American researcher, and went up to interview him. He was already officially retired, like a professor emeritus of the institute. So I just went to learn about his interesting background and his history. But at the end of the interview, he told me that he was working on amygdalin, and amygdalin was another name for laetrol, which was an extract of apricot kernels that was widely regarded by almost everybody in the scientific community as a worthless nostrum, basically as quackery. So I was quite astonished by this because what is that?
It was apricot seeds, wasn't it?
Correct. It's the internal part of the pit of the apricot. If you take a nutcracker to an apricot pit, what you see inside is a kernel, a softer kernel, and that was the source of this so-called medicine called laetrol. So I asked him, why would you work on this if we know that it is ineffective? And he said, but it isn't. And he took down his laboratory notebooks and showed me that laetrol basically did a couple of things. One is that it improved the healthiness of the mice. He had been working with mice in cancer for 60 years, so he knew what was a healthy mouse and what was a sick mouse. Secondly, it temporarily stopped the growth of small tumors. And the third and most important thing was it dramatically reduced the amount of spread of cancer, what scientists call the metastases of cancer, in this case from the original breast tumor to the lungs of the animals. And so he had observed this himself with his eyes and also with a magnifying glass. And as I say, he had 60 years of experience at Sloan Kettering in doing this kind of work. But more importantly, he submitted the materials, the lungs, to the pathology department at Memorial Hospital, a branch of Memorial Sloan Kettering. And the pathologist, eventually numbered five different pathologists, confirmed the fact that they were seeing dramatically fewer metastases in the lungs of the animals than in the animals that just got a salt water or saline solution. The upshot of this was, initially, the leaders of Sloan Kettering were very excited about this, very positive about it. They made two trips together to Washington to plead the case for these positive results and to plead for human clinical trials. But they were, I would say, very rudely rejected in this by people at the federal level and also by national fundraising foundations. And in March of 1975, they reversed their course completely, turned against Laetrile, got with the program, as it were, and started denouncing it and denying that Segura had had positive results that up until then they were advocating and they were championing.
This attack on him and his research came about because of what? Big Pharma? Medicine?
Well, ultimately, yes. Starting in 1953, the so-called cancer authorities, cancer experts in California particularly, started denouncing Laetrile because I think it was at that point more a matter of ego that Laetrile had popped up out of an obscure laboratory in San Francisco. It was being used by a few obscure doctors in Los Angeles, and starting to get a name for itself. There was a reporter on the East Coast who had gotten wind of this, and of course, since there was nothing at that point that could, you know, really treat advanced cancer, the public was starting to get a little bit interested or agitated about this, and the authorities came down very hard on them in California with a very shabby report that they wrote in 1953, but a lot of top people who went on to become top doctors in the United States went on record as saying, no, this is useless, it's quackery, it's quack medicine, these people are frauds, don't do this, we've got better methods of treating cancer, which at that point was surgery and radiation therapy, and just the glimmerings of the beginnings of chemotherapy. But, you know, there was a strong, let's say, not invented here attitude that we didn't think of this, and we don't know what it is. It's not part of our plans. Only the most foresighted people at that time saw what an industry chemotherapy in particular was going to become. A few did. I found a speech by Dusty Rhodes, president of Sloan Kettering, in which he was addressing the patent lawyers and saying in the future patent law will really determine the course of cancer therapy. But very few people, I think, had that foresight to realize what a tremendous multi-billion dollar industry this was about to become. I think it was initially more about egos and prestige and position and just a desire to assert themselves as the true experts that the public would look up to and give their money to, in terms of government money, but also in terms of private donations.
Did it bother you, Ralph, a person who basically came up in the traditional medical environment, to see this happen?
Well, of course. I mean, it bothered me, you know, tremendously. It was a crisis, a personal crisis for me. I had started out in the humanities, and I got my PhD from Stanford in classics, and then in 1974 decided, for a variety of reasons, to seek a career as a medical writer. And so I was a real outsider. I mean, I sold myself to Sloan Kettering on the grounds that I was an outsider and therefore could see things more the way that an average person or even an average donor might see things. In other words, the scientists had to explain things to me in simple terms because at that point I knew very little about medicine or about science. But I was fairly intelligent and able to understand things if they were explained, and I got along really well with the scientists there and started my scientific education there. Being an outsider, though, I couldn't understand, and I had no allegiance to the establishment. I hadn't been indoctrinated, leaving aside the, you know, scientific facts. I hadn't been indoctrinated into the club, as it were. So I was able, I think, to see things in some ways more clearly, not being part of their, you know, of their society. So I was sort of a visitor to to their world without actually being part of their world. But I couldn't countenance the idea of lying to the public. And initially, we weren't really lying to the public. We were, in 74, we were still basically being kind of neutral to the public, but telling the truth to the powers that be, that which went on for about another, you know, for about 2 years. And then, as I say, in 75, they were rejected at the federal level, came back on the train from Washington, dejected, as my boss's boss said, "I'm not going to die on the barricades for Laetrile. It's only a palliative drug. If it were a cure, it might be something else, but I'm not going to die on the barricades for this so-called palliative drug," although I would dispute the word palliative in that case. I don't think it just masked symptoms. I think it really did something in the animals in terms of stopping the spread of the cancer.
Now, one of the things that the FDA did is they talked about Laetrile having cyanide in that it killed people. How widespread was that?
How widespread was the deaths of people from taking Laetrile?
The FDA pushed to convince people.
Well, let's clarify. I mean, there is the potential release of cyanide from taking Laetrile or amygdalin, especially when it's taken by mouth. I don't think there's any evidence that when it's injected, it actually increases cyanide levels, but certainly nobody ever died from taking Laetrile, the medicine, by injection. Three people died over the course of the history of Laetrile, which dates now for more than 60 years. Three people have died from ingesting, taking by mouth, injectable material that was meant to be, you know, taken intravenously. So there is a potential, if you drink the medicine Laetrile, to free up the cyanide and to and then potentially get sick or even die. A child in Buffalo and two women in California had this happen to them. Geez. On that basis, on the basis of three out of definitely tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people taking it safely, the FDA put up kind of wanted posters in over 20,000 post offices across the United States, warning people that Laetrile was a deadly poison and they must not take it, and they should, you know, seek out their doctor or professional help to understand these matters. So they took a kernel of truth, which is that, yes, there is the potential for releasing cyanide in Laetrile, and they blew that out of all proportion into making Laetrile seem like an extremely dangerous substance, when in fact they knew that in all of history, I mean, even if you ate apricot kernels or other kernels of fruit to excess, it was extremely rare for people to die from that source compared to, let's say, acetaminophen, one of the brand names is Tylenol, which really is dangerous if you take it in not such doses that are not so much higher than what many people in our country take, and many people have died from as a result of liver damage caused by acetaminophen, but they didn't put any posters up about acetaminophen in the post office. But Laetrile, with its three deaths over a period of 50 years, that required big warning posters in every post office in the country.
If you merely ate apricots, would that help you?
Oh, we don't know. There was an animal study done at Texas A&M a couple of months ago, showing that the certain substances in the flesh of the apricot did diminish the amount of cancer in animals. So it's possible. It's possible that among many other natural substances, apricots could have some benefit.
Where does the research for Laetrile stand today? Is it dead, Ralph?
It's dead in the United States. all but dead, I would say. In Germany, just this month, this past month, there was a paper published on bladder cancer, three cell lines of bladder cancer, showing a clear dose-response relationship between giving, administering Laetrile or amygdalin to these three different kinds of bladder cancer cells and killing of the cancer cells. So this happened at two of the top universities in Germany, including Göttingen, which is was the home to 44 different Nobel laureates over the years. So this is top drawer research that just appeared this month. No connection to me, I think, but it's a nice coincidence. And in Spain, there's interesting work going on where they removed the cyanide from the Laetrile, and they still got the anti-cancer effect. It seemed to be tied to a decrease in inflammation, which is a known way of decreasing the amount of cancer, because inflammation is sort of the seedbed of cancer. When you have a chronic inflammation in your body, you're at heightened risk of cancer. So Dr. Perez in Barcelona, Spain, was able to show that they could, even if they took out the cyanide, Laetrile still worked in the animal systems.
Now, Laetrile, of course, is also called vitamin B17, isn't it?
That's a name for it, yeah.
I don't agree
with that. I do not agree that it's vitamin, that it's a vitamin at all.
But they call it that.
Yes. Oddly enough, that name, B17, sort of overtook Laetrile, which is almost impossible to pronounce, and it's very peculiar spelling. People didn't really take to that name too well. But the B-17, with its sort of reminder of the heavy-duty bombers of World War II,
That's exactly right.
So that caught on, and there is this theory that Laetrile, that kernels of fruits constitute a hidden, unknown, a hitherto unknown vitamin, which Dr. Ernst Krebs called B17. But if you think about the history of different populations in the world, we could just take the Eskimo, for instance. The Eskimo eat, there are parts of, you know, subgroups of the Eskimo that eat no Laetrile, no amygdalin, or so-called B17, yet they had remarkably low levels of cancer. They were noted in the 1920s and 1930s for their lack of cancer, and you could say the same thing about the Maasai in Africa. So there's no correlation between not eating Laetrile or B17 and having cancer, or conversely, if you eat a lot of B17, that doesn't protect you from cancer. And there is a population in China that eats a lot of B17 in millet, and they have astronomical rates of cancer of the esophagus. So I think the theory is completely false. I mean, Laetrile may have some anti-cancer activity if you eat the kernels, but it's not advisable. 5 or 6 kernels for an adult is not likely to harm them. But as you get into the higher numbers, it would be possible to die from overeating the apricot kernel. So there is a small public health issue involved in this. And I understand, I mean, if FDA wanted to speak truthfully about Laetrile and say it's not high up on the list of dangerous things, but everybody should be aware that the overconsumption of these kernels could be a serious problem, you know, I would have no problem with them saying that. And as I say, I also depart company from the so-called Laetrileists over the issue of the B17, which doesn't make any sense at all scientifically.
Ralph, let's take this quick break, and we'll come back with much more to talk with you about on Coast to Coast AM. If you are a Coast Insider, tomorrow, 8 p.m. Pacific time, will be our special computer chat with the Nostradamus look-alike, Mr. John Hoag. So make sure you sign up. That room fills up awfully fast. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Ralph Moss with us. Ralph, God forbid, but if you had cancer, would you try to use Laetril?
I would go to a clinic where they were using a variety of innovative types of treatments. Some of those clinics use Laetril, some don't. I think that from what I've seen, and I've seen both, you know, the science of it and also the medical side of it, I don't think Laetril is very effective against advanced cancers, stage 4 cancers. So I think it would depend on what stage the cancer was in. If you're trying to prevent the cancer from spreading, let's say if it's in stage 3 and you've had an operation and now you're concerned about the disease, coming back, recurring or spreading, then let's put it this way: the science of it, the laboratory science, is very positive on that. But for the treatment of advanced cancer, if surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy are not curative, then I like what happens in some of the foreign clinics better than the standard options that are given to American cancer patients.
Sadly, Ralph, as we speak, my sister has stage 4 brain cancer.
Sorry.
When they caught it, it was already at the stage 4 level. They had given her 6 months. She's gone well over a year and 6 months, but
yeah,
that clock is ticking now. And
I
had talked to her in the beginning stages about doing some alternative and some natural, to coincide
right
with what they wanted to do, which was traditional medicine. But they primarily opted to go the traditional medicine route. I think,
yeah,
God forbid, if it happened to me, I would try to use both as aggressively as I could.
If you can do that, that is the best way. I firmly believe that. And there's no monopoly on truth. So there are things in the standard medical world of oncology that are very good and very useful. There are things in the complementary field that are unrecognized by the textbook medicine people, but also many indications of benefit. The best survival, in my opinion, comes about when people are able to integrate the high quality conventional care with high quality complementary care.
Have you ever heard of the work of Dr. Tullio Simoncini out of Italy? What do you think of that concept of using sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, to treat cancer?
I've read his book. And from a theoretical point of view, he holds that cancer is a fungus, not that cancer is caused by a fungus, which would be pretty far out to begin with, but that cancer actually is a fungus, which is not credible. Because if you analyze the DNA of the tumor, two things are obvious. One is it's human cells. And the second thing is it's the cells of the person who is afflicted with the disease, but they've been transformed in some way and made abnormal in some way to the point where they refuse to die. And so I think it's very well established that cancer is a human disease which is involved at some level with genetic abnormalities. So the idea that cancer is a fungus, which I believe is actually the name of his book, is just nonsensical, and so I would reject that wholeheartedly. But as to whether sodium bicarbonate would have a beneficial effect, cancers tend to be acidic. But the acidity of the tumor is not the cause of the cancer; it's the result of the cancer. Cancers tend also to be very avid consumers of glucose, of sugar.
They love sugar,
They love sugar, and about up to 50% of the energy of a cancer cell is derived from the direct breakdown of glucose. And the byproduct of that is, one of the byproducts is lactic acid. So cancers tend to be acidic. And that lactic acid is used by the cancer to spread, because the acid in the tumor weakens the adjoining cell, normal cells, and then leads to one of the mechanisms by which the cancer then is able to invade adjoining tissues. So there is some issue here with the acidity of tumors, but pouring sodium bicarbonate on such a phenomenon may temporarily stop its growth or its spread, but I don't really see how it would get at the root cause of the cancer. That doesn't seem very likely to me. There's only one experiment that makes me hesitate, and that is in Florida, there is a group doing research with feeding sodium bicarbonate to rats, and they have claimed that there are smaller tumors and fewer tumors in the rats that got the sodium bicarbonate in the drinking water. You know, you can't just take an animal study, whether it's about sodium bicarbonate, laetrile, or chemotherapy, and to automatically say, well, that proves that, you know, you should do this in people, because, first of all, there's too many animal studies, and secondly, things that work in the rat notoriously may not work in the cancer patient, or you may need to do very extensive research before you see how it could be useful. It's appealing, of course. The sodium bicarbonate is very appealing because it's something available in every drugstore and every supermarket, so one would like to believe that it's beneficial. I have no prejudice against it. It's just that we can't build a whole philosophy around, you know, one or two animal studies. And as I say, when somebody puts forward a treatment that contains some obvious, blatant misstatements and misunderstandings of basic biology, you know, you tend to look less sympathetically at the whole of that person's work, although it's possible a person could be totally wrong on a theoretical level, but, you know, have by luck or happenstance have come upon something useful. But I'm not a fan of Simoncini or his work.
Okay. Is the FDA working for our behalf or not?
Oh, boy.
Putting you on the old spot, Ralph.
So their stated mission is to protect the public from harm coming from useless medicines or from contaminated food. And to the extent that they carry out their actual mission, most of the time they're doing good and they are necessary, and I'm glad they're there. But as with many government agencies, there's a very strong tendency to overreach and also to become compromised by the very industries that they were set up to regulate. This is called agency capture in the world of economics and politics. So I think in the case of Laetrile, they acted like certainly they overreached, because it isn't necessary to go hunting down every person who's trying to take Laetrile, suing them, arresting them, stopping them, all the people trying to utilize this either as patients or as doctors should be left alone, basically. They're not harming anybody. They're just exercising their own freedom of choice, which is a hallowed concept. Sure. in politics and more and more in medicine. But and the other issue is, to what degree now has FDA become a branch of the pharmaceutical industry, a very, very indispensable branch? A former official of the FDA, whose name was William Vodra, put it in an article. He said, who's going to buy, I'm paraphrasing, but who's going to buy chemotherapy at $70,000? A treatment when they can get Laetrile for 75 cents. And that's
so
the
true.
Crux. You know, I wrote a book on this called The Cancer Industry. My book, Doctored Results, which is my current book about the laetrile phenomenon, or the let's say the way the testing was distorted at Sloan Kettering, is about this. I've been talking about this since at least 1977, so I'm quite familiar with this topic, and I'd say that FDA has to clean house. They have to eliminate the bias that they have towards big pharma, if that's possible. I don't know. I mean, I'm just not sure that it can even be done at this point. But everything is stacked on behalf of and in favor of the large pharmaceutical companies, and they expect super profits from their cancer drugs, and they don't expect something like laetrile to be acceptable when it costs so little amount of money and it's in the public domain. By the way, I wanted to mention that Eric Marola, the producer of the Second Opinion film that's opening in New York on this August 29th, which is Friday, has started a petition, and it's a petition to get Sloan Kettering to re-examine and reopen and acknowledge the positive results with laetrile that were achieved in the 1970s. So if people are interested, they could go to secondopinionfilm.com or change.org, which is where the petition was initiated. He's gotten over 1,000 signatures already, but we very much need more and more people to sign up at secondopinionfilm.com.
Very good. So the muscular dystrophy telethon will be over the Labor Day weekend again, as it is all the time. And, I can remember this thing 36, 40 years ago with Jerry Lewis pushing it. We're not any closer, I don't think, of solving muscular dystrophy. We've spent and we've raised got to be $1 billion+ just over those 30 plus years. Why can't they solve anything, Ralph? They get all money. Do they want to solve it? I mean, honestly?
I remember once when I was new at Sloan Kettering, there was a cancer cure scare. The word suddenly went through the office that they had found a cure for cancer. It was false, of course. But that false rumor is very interesting to see how people responded, because there wasn't jubilation in the halls. Believe me, it was a lot of fear, because we were going to lose our jobs. And it only, it only lasted less than a day, but it was still very instructive for me that human nature, we cherish our jobs and we cherish our homes and our families. And when something threatens that, you react instinctively to protect yourself and protect your economic well-being. I mean, that's just human nature. So I think we can put up all kinds of high and mighty phrases about how we're going to cure cancer in your lifetime and all that baloney. But when it comes right down to it, people in the field are pretty comfortable. Oncologists are, I think, the third most highly paid type of doctor in the United States. And I don't find a tremendous amount of, among the, let's say, the average oncologist, there isn't a tremendous amount of impatience to find really definitive treatments. They're very comfortable with the very slow, glacially slow progress in the field. And, I think that there's a lot of foot dragging. And not really, like when we started the war on cancer, the whole purpose of starting the war on cancer was to put a massive infusion of cash into the situation. And then people don't remember that it also was about bypassing the federal bureaucracy. They appointed a cancer czar, and the cancer czar could go straight to the President of the United States in order to implement the most promising things. That's how laetrile got tested. It was part of that cancer czar initiative. But it's easy to trip these things up and to say, no, we don't accept these results, or everybody else is getting different results. And they very quickly were able to tie laetrile up in knots, because if 10 experts, so-called, in the field get up and contradict a simple fact, most people are then going to be very confused. They're not going to be able to see that the fact is not diminished by 10 experts saying that it doesn't exist. But that's what happens. The minute you come up with something that's really meaningful, if it isn't championed by a big, very wealthy drug company, there's zero interest.
Of course, yeah, and I've long suspected exactly what you've just said. There is no euphoria when the word gets out that there might be a cure.
Right. I'll give you a very good example. In Belgium, 4 years ago, they observed that women who had had surgery for breast cancer, who got non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, a particular one that is known in the United States but not widely used, had dramatically fewer recurrences, early recurrences of their breast cancer than people who got painkillers that were not NSAIDs. So you would think that the whole world would come to a screeching halt at that point and say, if you have one, I think it was like one quarter or one fifth the number of recurrences, which is a big problem, by the way, in breast cancer, especially like 1 year, 1.5 years after the surgery, a fair number of women come back with metastases or recurrences of their breast cancer. If you could stop it with a simple 10-cent pill, I mean, maybe even aspirin, which is in that same category,
mm-hmm.
shouldn't that be like item number one in what's going to be tested? And all they did, they ignored it, and the people who acknowledged that it even existed when they were asked about it said, well, it's too small a study, and it's only one place that showed this. And so this is to ignore all the evidence over in so many directions about aspirin and other anti-inflammatory drugs having a profound effect on stopping the recurrence of cancer. So where has the aspirin research been all these years? And every time it comes up in another context, it's like, you know, that's not so important. It's not so exciting.
That's amazing.
Right, because aspirin's what, you know, 2 cents a day?
Exactly.
And chemotherapy now is $100,000 to $125,000 per patient. That's for one drug.
They so why give aspirin when you can do that?
Correct. Exactly.
Something wrong there, Ralph. You know, I'm a believer that every illness on this planet, that the planet has a cure for it. We just have to find it.
Yeah.
Everyone, whatever the disease is, there's a cure for it on the planet. You just have to find
right.
it.
Right. You know, type 2 diabetes can be controlled through diet and exercise.
And absolutely. And supplements. Massive, there's certain supplements you can take to really bring those glucose levels down.
Right. And you know that the main drug used in diabetes, metformin, is a derivative of an herb. It's French lilac.
Exactly. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take phone calls with Dr. Ralph Moss, PhD, on Coast to Coast AM.